Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on, we're going to be speaking with Larry Merkuliev, who is a Native American Aleut, actually indigenous activist and person who's going to be in New Mexico talking about global warming and its effect on Alaskan ecosystems. Right now, I would like to welcome Cynthia Gonzalez. She is the executive director of the New Mexico Suicide Intervention Project, and Deborah Luckett, who is the training and education coordinator for that project. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you.
Good morning.
Now, this is a suicide intervention project, which exists for obvious reasons to prevent suicide in young people. How bad a problem do we have in New Mexico?
The problem is very big in New Mexico. Youth suicide is the second leading cause of death for young people in New Mexico, ages 10 through 24 years of age. And in fact,
that's huge.
It's huge. And in Santa Fe County, it's estimated that about 20% of young people in high school age young people, have attempted suicide.
And 20%.
20%. And when you think of...
One in five.
And when you think of those are the young people who've attempted, how many of those have... how many other young people have actually thought about suicide? So when you look at it in those terms, it is a tremendous problem. New Mexico, as a state, ranks usually in the top five states in the nation for the highest rate of youth suicide. And the New Mexico Suicide Intervention Project is here and was established in 1994 to decrease the likelihood of suicidal behaviors in young people.
And so that's the project that you do. How do you do it? How do you identify young people who are at risk of being suicidal?
There are certain risk factors that we look for in young people who we think are at higher risk. And the big problem, and one of the problems in trying to do that is trying to figure out what is regular or normal adolescent behavior, which some of these risk factors overlap, and what is really suicidal behavior.
Yeah, I mean, one of the risk factors is a recent breakup. Well, to whom has that not happened?
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we look at 3 to 5 warning signs. So when you look at the list of warning signs, it's not just one factor. It's about 3 to 5 of those in combination.
So when you have 3 to 5, then the risk goes up?
Absolutely.
So what are some of those warning factors?
One high risk factor could be a prior suicide attempt that puts you at higher risk. Prolonged periods of hopelessness. Family conflict is a risk factor, and as Deb said, it's not just family conflict, but family conflict, having difficulty in school, discipline problems, peer conflicts, as well as a feeling of hopelessness or major loss in a young person's life. All those together could be one thing could tip. Be the breaking point.
I noticed that on your list, one of the things was people giving away their possessions.
Yes, in fact, when someone is planning on committing suicide, a lot of times they'll give away something special to a friend or family member, you know, special CDs or a piece of clothing that they'd like to give to them. So we see that sometimes.
And so that's really a warning sign for people. So how do you work with these young people? Well, first of all, how do you, because these are the warning signs, but how do you actually identify them and get them into the project?
Several ways. One of the things we're doing is teaching counselors and teachers and other adults who work with young people how to identify these warning signs. And so, so teaching them as well as students how to identify these warning signs in a friend or a peer and in themselves as well. So those are two ways. The other way is we train graduate students coming out of social work and counseling departments who are working on their graduate degree and licensure how to recognize these warning signs, how to diagnose, and how to intervene with a young person who is at high risk. So we're teaching people at all different levels, professionals all the way to the students themselves, and that's what DAB does a whole lot of, and we think is so important if students can recognize the warning signs in themselves and how to get help for themselves. That's a huge success for the project.
We're talking about the New Mexico Suicide Intervention Project. So then you've got kids who are going through it, and it's, you know, a hard time, and they're at risk for suicide. So how do you bring them into the project, and then what do you do when they're there?
Well, we train kids first to identify the warning signs in a friend or themselves. Once you observe and notice these signs, we talk about just showing a lot of concern for that person who might be struggling with these issues. And then to actually ask that tough question, to ask someone if they're suicidal. Most times people, they know they might be thinking about it, but they really fear about asking it. Well, the research shows if you ask if someone is suicidal, it provides relief. And it won't make someone, it won't put that thought in their head, and it won't make them do it.
Yeah, people are afraid to ask because they think, oh, if I ask that question, then maybe that will plant the idea in their head. That's not true?
That's not true at all, and there's a lot of research supporting that. So go ahead and ask that question. If they do say yes, then we brainstorm a lot of resources in the area that could help that person identify that caring adult, whether it's a teacher, a counselor, the Sky Center, other resources for
that person. I noticed you didn't say parent.
Or parent, absolutely.
Because I was thinking the reason you didn't say that maybe was because people who are in that position often have so much trouble at home.
Well, in fact, we always involve the parent at some point. And they're the person who can get them that help and access to the other resources. And make sure that they're safe, especially when they're suicidal, especially after school between 3 and 5. Sometimes parents work. Well, you work with the parent to find other support resources so they're not alone and they're safe. And another factor is firearms in the house. And we work with the parents to make sure that there are no firearms, accessible firearms for the individual.
So you find a kid who is suicidal and you say to the parents, you got to get all your guns out of the house.
Yes.
And do they? I mean, does that work?
Most of the time, yes, because in most cases, I would say 95-98% of cases, parents want to do, they don't want to lose their child. And so they are willing to do whatever to protect their child. And we just know from the history of youth suicide in the state that firearms are one of the major ways that young people do take their lives, and that's why it's so important to get rid of them. And as Deb was saying, parents are critically important to youth suicide prevention. And when a young person may be referred to us for counseling, we do have a counseling center called the Sky Counseling Center, and we offer free counseling to young people and their families. And the reason we involve the family so much is those parents and family members provide the protection that the child needs if he or she is suicidal.
So what are the sessions like? So you bring a young person in, maybe a 13-year-old boy or girl or whatever age, and then their parents, and then you sit in a room with a couch and a one-way mirror, whatever it's called, two-way mirror, and videotapes and all this stuff. I mean, it sounds a little scary.
It sounds a little intense, doesn't it? Well, because we are a training center, we do what's called supervision of graduate students who are actually the ones who are in the counseling room with the family, and then behind a one-way mirror is a team of professionals, the student's supervisor, as well as intern students from various universities around the state. And so, so the family is in the counseling room and is being videotaped, and they're aware of all of this because the videotapes are used for training purposes. But what that graduate student is learning to do is how to work with high-risk families and young people, how to ask those difficult questions. That's one of the things. The other is then how do I give and help a young person? How do I give a young person, train a young person in the skills that will help them cope with whatever serious problem it is that they bring to the Sky Center in the counseling session? And sometimes that needs to be a whole team of professionals who can advise a family and a young person on how to cope with the problems they may have, how to manage their moods, how to make good decisions.
I would think that even before that, you would have to just let the person have some time to talk about what's wrong in the first place.
Absolutely. That being able just to listen is the first thing. And many times a young person may come in because they are having problems at school. And some of the problems they're having and the magnitude of those problems doesn't become apparent or isn't apparent to the parents until they're in the counseling session. And a lot of times that'll come out. And if there are other things bothering the young person, one of those could be, I'm thinking about hurting myself, or I'm sad all the time and I don't know what to do about it.
Are gay teenagers at higher risk than others?
Just being gay or lesbian does not put them at higher risk. However, the victimization many of these young people feel at school does. And I'll let Deb talk a little bit more about that, because she works with gay and lesbian youth in the public schools.
Well, we do a lot of work on bullying and victimization, and for those that are victimized, different strategies they can use so they're safer in school. So, and that pertains to youth that are gay and lesbian, or any youth that are victimized.
So it's really the victimization rather than anything else.
That's the key component, yes.
Very interesting. How many therapists know how to work with suicidal kids? I mean, is that part of your therapist? Is that part of the normal training?
I was a school counselor for approximately 10 years, and we had a little bit of training on how to deal with a suicidal student, but nothing like the Sky Center provides. I would say, you know, a class session on how to do a suicide contract, you know, and it's much more intense than that. And just the collaboration with the
family. What's a suicide contract?
A suicide contract is when someone's actively suicidal, to provide the name of three individuals that they trust that they can call, and then also to provide three activities they can do instead of harming themselves. So what you're doing is actually helping them brainstorm positive coping strategies.
What are some of those positive coping strategies?
I think it's different for everybody, but a lot of the things that I've seen is, you know, talk to a good friend, listen to music, exercise, and those type of things.
Now, one of the things that we were talking about when the three of us had a conversation the other day was that it's not really that these young people want to die, it's just that they want to be free of their pain, and that's an important distinction to make.
Exactly. Young people who do kill themselves don't think of it as being a permanent solution. They just really want to get out of the pain that they're in, and they don't have a list of different strategies, like Deb was saying, of ways to cope with the pain, or a friend to go to, or an adult that they trust to go to. And the more we can surround young people with a positive social network, people who are watching over that child and that they feel really connected to, the more we can protect them from suicide. That's one of the big what we call protective factors, is a strong connectedness to their school and to their family and community.
Well, that it does really lead to the question of alienation. I mean, for if somebody wants to take their own life, or if somebody is in that much pain, that connectedness just isn't there. Why is there? I mean, one person in five, one young person in five, one high school student in five making an attempt to take their own life. What does that say about our society?
Well, that we're disconnected in a lot of ways. And what we are trying to do at in our training, in our family counseling, in the work that Deb does in the schools and health education classes and with her peer helping program, is try to bring back that connectedness. And that's why we'd like to get all the adults who work with young people together and trained, because the more we have people watching and being there for a young person who can talk to a young person about this serious subject, the more the young person will feel connected. And again, that's an adult who's a teacher or a parent who can talk to them about it.
We're talking about the New Mexico Suicide Intervention Project. Cynthia Gonzalez and Deborah Luckett are here with us. And it's very important, I think, to talk about this kind of thing on the radio, because a lot of people may not know about the resources that you have. If for example, let's say a teacher is listening or a parent, can they just call you and have a conversation about this?
Absolutely. I'd be more than happy to talk about different types of training opportunities. However, if they have a young person or a person they know that is actively suicidal, we do have a national hotline number.
Which is 800-273-8255, ladies and gentlemen.
So we're not a crisis center.
Right.
However, we do provide lots of support and community resources as well. We can direct them to some areas for counseling.
The effects of suicide on the family and the school and the community are also huge, and I guess you also deal with that.
We do. The effects are overwhelming. There's usually a tremendous amount of guilt following a student suicide, as you and your listeners can imagine. It's pretty devastating.
If only I had done this, if only I had been there.
Right. And what we try to do, if there has been a youth suicide, we do provide what we call postvention services. That's a scientific name for going into a school community.
After it's like intervention only post.
Post. Going into a school community after there's been a student suicide. And what we find are that the administrative staff, the teachers, and all the students are overwhelmed by the problem. So we help them work through that whole first week, day, week after a suicide. Everything from helping teachers make an announcement to their other classes. Usually there's such a feeling of course, grief and sadness that they're not able to do that. So we'll go do that for them. We'll help them figure out how to tell the other parents. And we'll gather all the parents together and talk to them about suicide warning signs and ways to help their own child cope with the days and weeks following a student suicide. After that suicide happens in a school, the whole school community is extremely vulnerable. And we do see what's called a contagion effect, where a young person who may not have known the child that died by suicide, who is having some difficulty on their own, may see suicide as an option because someone else in the school did. And so we have to really surround those young people and protect them.
Now you, Deborah, were a school counselor in Colorado.
Yes.
Around the time of Columbine.
I arrived shortly thereafter, yeah.
And what was it like for students who may not even have been directly involved, like knowing these young people, what was the ripple effect on your students?
Especially during anniversary time, we were always watching out for our students, but especially around the anniversary. We just paid special attention to the different warning signs and tried to identify any student at risk.
I mean, did they get freaked out during those anniversaries?
I think the adults probably got more freaked out than the kids did. They got back into the routine pretty well. And they kept busy with their after-school activities, and they're well-connected with school. But we were very vigilant in identifying students at our particular school who might be exhibiting any of the warning signs. And a lot of that dealt with a result of collaborating with teachers and parents. I mean, we work together. One person can't do it all.
Right.
And administration, and people in the cafeteria, and bus drivers. I mean, we all talked to each other and looked out for our kids.
And I think that I just like to add that what Deb was saying is so true. One person can't do it all. It really is a collaborative effort between the families, the school, and community folks. I mean, that soccer coach or football coach could be a very critical person in a child's life.
Now, the Sky Center has been around for, what, 10 years?
Has been around for 10 years. It's located at the College of Santa Fe, on the College of Santa Fe campus. And as I said before, I think that, it offers free counseling.
Yeah, which is amazing. Can you tell in the 10 years that you've been here, I mean, do you keep statistics on how effective the work actually is? Is that possible to do?
Yeah, we do keep some statistics. We see about 200 young people and their family members each school year. And by the way, we are open during the school year. We run on an academic school year calendar.
Right.
So we see about 250 young people. Of those young people, 80% are Hispanic, or 75% are Hispanic. The rest are Caucasian, and I think about 2%. Native American young people. Those young people who come to the Sky Center can come for a number of different reasons, from being bullied, drugs and alcohol, again, I'll say family conflict or peer conflict. Those may be the factors that drive them to, or that they're referred to the Sky Center for, as well as suicide attempt or thinking about taking their own lives. So we really have a huge spectrum of young people, of problems that bring them to the Sky Center. And what we see as a success is that if a young person and his or her family comes to the Sky Center, what we want them to be able to do is, again, detect for themselves when they're having problems that are overwhelming and that they need help. And so they may come back to the Sky Center again throughout the young person's high school, middle school, or high school career. But we really do see that as a success. A young person and their family are asking for, and know when to ask for help.
Have the suicide rates actually gone down?
And the suicide rates have gone down, Mary Charlotte.
That's quite something.
Yeah. That's what we're trying to do. Back in the early 90s, Santa Fe County had the 10th highest suicide rate. I mean, number one in suicide rates.
Santa Fe County?
Santa Fe County was number one. It is now 10 in the state. So that is a significant improvement in youth suicide rates. And I really think it is because of this, what we call sort of multifaceted approach of education, awareness, and counseling that helps.
Cynthia Gonzalez is the executive director of the New Mexico Suicide Intervention Project. Deborah Luckett is the training and education coordinator. And ladies and gentlemen, take out your pencils right now because we're going to give you all the numbers. The number at the center is 820-1066. And Deborah's number, if you would like to call her directly about training and education, is 699-0605. And if you are in crisis or you know anybody who's in crisis, there is a national crisis number, which is toll-free, 800-273-8255. And the New Mexico Suicide Intervention Project is on the web at nmsip.org. I think we got it covered there. Thank you, Cynthia and Deborah, so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. Please stay tuned to KSFR. We're going to be talking about Alaska and global warming and much more in just a few minutes. I'd like to welcome now, joining us by telephone, Larry Merkuliev. He is the co-founder and former chairman of the Alaska Indigenous Council on Marine Mammals, the former chairman of the Nature Conservancy Alaska Chapter, former co-director of the Native American Fish and Wildlife Society Alaska Chapter, much, much more environmental work than I can talk about right here. But welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, Larry.
Thank you, and good morning to all your listeners.
Good morning. And you will be in New Mexico tomorrow speaking about climate change and Alaska at Sunrise Springs right here, right outside of Santa Fe at 5:30 in the afternoon. You were born and raised in Alaska, and as I understand it, you had a traditional Aleut upbringing. You've also seen the effects of climate change firsthand. What are some of the changes that are happening in Alaska?
Well, that's true. I was born and raised out in the Pribilof Islands, which is in the middle of the Bering Sea, and my generation was the last generation that had a fully traditional upbringing. And it's actually our people in the Bering Sea, we've been out there for about 10,000 years, you know, that's 6,000 years before the height of the pyramid cultures in Egypt. And we were the first ones to notice the changes that were ecosystem-wide in scope throughout the entire Bering Sea. And we've seen so many changes. I mean, we talk about Alaska being ground zero and the proverbial canary in the coal mine for the rest of the world in terms of what impacts can happen and visit all these different parts of the world. So for example, I mean, the changes that are occurring are profound. They're huge. They're large. For example, stellar sea lions have declined in population over the last 30 years by about 80%. Northern fur seals down by 60 to 70%. Sea otters down by 80%, harbor seals down by 70%, eider ducks down by 80%, walrus are having severe problems. Of course, we know that polar bear are. Crabs have virtually disappeared throughout the Bering Sea. And then, of course, I visited other parts of Alaska, and there are equally profound changes occurring there, which I can talk about.
It's really ironic the extent to which indigenous communities, which really have probably done the least to contribute to climate change, are the ones who are having the deepest effects from it.
Yeah, that's very true. I think worldwide, it's people who are the closest to the land and depend upon the land and the waters are going to get the brunt end of the climate change events that are occurring. Out in Alaska, you know, we consume about 420 pounds of wild foods per year per capita, and that's probably the most wild foods eaten by any group of people in the entire United States. And so these changes are having really deep, deep effects on our people.
When you say that you are from the last generation that really had a traditional upbringing, in the place from which you come, in the, you know, the Aleutian Islands and the Bering Sea, how does climate change affect the traditional way of life? In other words, is it that the food supply is just so compromised?
The food supplies are being compromised severely. I mean, even salmon are being affected. The elders in Alaska think that salmon may very well disappear in the next 10 to 15 years entirely from the entire state of Alaska because of the problems. And our people have such a dependency on it. We have a subsistence economy where a lot of our foods, our nutrition, our community well-being, our cultural systems are totally dependent upon the health and well-being of the ecosystem itself. So I'll give you a specific example of one of the dramatic effects it's had, in my opinion, out there back home on St. Paul Island. You know, we're called people of the sea lion. We consume more stellar sea lion than any other indigenous group in Alaska. And it's the basis for enculturation of our young men. So the young men would go out with the older hunters, and they would learn about relationship, about respect and reverence for the environment, about hunting, the proper hunting protocols, about the ethics and values of sharing in the community, et cetera, about what it means to be a man. And when the sea lions decline by 80%, our hunters are self-regulating. They don't go out if the numbers are down. And as a result, the connection between the younger men and the older men have been effectively severed. And one of the unfortunate and tragic results of that, in my opinion, is that we had lost in one 10-year period 70% of our young men between the ages of 17 and 27 due to accidental deaths due to suicide, incarceration for felony crimes, it was just a profound tragic loss that we experienced.
Did you say 70%?
70.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's a big loss to our community as a result of that. And I don't think there's going to be any indigenous group in Alaska that's going to be unaffected by this. It's having really, really heavy and tragic results. And another thing that's happening with intensified storms and the weather systems that are changing so dramatically, our hunters are not able to predict weather as accurately as they used to. In some cases, we've had, we've had quite a few deaths in Alaska due to melting ice and getting caught in inclement weather systems.
We're talking to Larry Merkuliev. He is going to be speaking tomorrow at Sunrise Springs, tomorrow, Wednesday, the 7th of May, right here outside of Santa Fe. Now, you have a long, long history of public service and advocacy for Native communities. Tell us about the movement for subsistence rights in Alaska.
Well, I think we continue to have struggles there, particularly with the rules and regulations that are promulgated up there, trying to control our subsistence rights. I led up an effort, it was the largest subsistence rights march in Alaska about 5 years ago to stop the state of Alaska from protesting a lower court decision that effectively protected our subsistence rights along the rivers where we traditionally had used them. And fortunately, we were successful in that. There was another effort that I led for getting federal and national and international recognition of our people's right to take halibut for subsistence. Our people have been taking it for thousands of years, but the system didn't recognized either federally or statewide, and again, that was a four-year effort to take just 1% of the human take of halibut. 99% were taken by sports and commercial fishermen, and we received a lot of opposition from several groups dealing with that kind of thing. And then the rules and regulations are, we're probably the most regulated people in the United States, because we eat and take a lot of things out of the natural environment, where we have a symbiotic relationship and a relationship of reciprocity with the environment using our traditional ways, which have been so successful for thousands of years. And because of we take so much, it's not like an individual hunter going out for a moose, for example, in the sports hunting. They might go out once a year or something like that. Our people are out there every day, and taking not just moose, but we're taking all the other kinds of species there, and every one of them have got their own individual regulations. And so regulations also, I think, are changing the way that our cultures do things up there in Alaska. And that's, you know, compounded by the fact that all these species are declining.
Right, right. I mean, you've been so active in doing things like making this legislation happen and making it go through. How do you make legislative distinctions between subsistence and sport fishing, for example?
Well, that's pretty easy. There's a lot of different standards that we indigenous peoples totally understand. One, of course, is that we have a historical and cultural ties to a particular species, and two, it's a major supplement to our diet. It has cultural ramifications. It has ramifications for our language. It has ramifications for, it's a communal sharing system that we've got up in Alaska in every single group, every single village. Whereas sports fishermen, you know, they're going out for their families or for themselves.
Right, right. Now, you've worked for legislation to protect marine mammals, and you just talked about some of the horrible statistics of the very large declines in marine mammals in Alaska. Tell us about this work and how it's working or not working.
Well, one of the things that we're very concerned about is that what historically has happened is that when there's something adverse happening to a particular marine mammal, the federal agencies and the general public and particular advocacy groups might, they would be, it'd be the indigenous peoples that are first targeted. And that certainly happened out in the Pribilof Islands, where we eat northern fur seal for food during the summertime. And certain groups certainly opposed our efforts to take a seal for our food. And we can prove through archaeological evidence in the midden sites in Alaska and the Aleutian Chain that we've eaten seals for 10,000 years. But yet, I've had to be in the halls of Congress arguing with staffers who are saying, "Well, why can't you eat beef and chicken? And you don't have to take seals for food." It's I think due to a lot of ignorance and misunderstanding, as well as arrogance, even.
Are there laws that do protect effectively marine mammals at this point?
Yes, there are. The Marine Mammal Protection Act is the major act, I think, that applies to a lot of the marine mammals up in Alaska. That's governed by the Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the National Marine Fisheries Service. And we've worked hard in developing co-management agreements with these agencies so that we are, the indigenous peoples are the ones responsible for determining what we need to do, what we need to take in terms of our food requirements. And I want to point out that this whole word subsistence is a little bit misleading. I mean, in the part of the challenge we've got with these laws is that it simply relegates it to in economic terms or food need terms. Granted, that is probably the number one priority, but also they're such an integral part of our way of life and our cultures and our and working with our youth so that they begin to learn how to respect and revere not only the animals that we take, but also, you know, learn the ethics and values. We don't take any more than we need, ever. And we don't waste. And whatever we take must and should be shared with everyone in the community. And so these are really important aspects of subsistence that I think many people really don't understand.
Do you feel that Native communities are well represented when it comes to the conversations that are going on in Alaska, whether they be scientific or political, about climate change?
Well, it's beginning. You know, our people were the ones in the Bering Sea to flag the beginnings of these problems back in 1977. And up until, oh, I would say 10 years ago, we were met with deaf ears. The agencies and the various boards and councils that deal with the scientists considered our information anecdotal, which would be like interesting pieces of information that may or may not be useful. And the Western system is not set up to affirm information that is gathered from an indigenous way of life and observations. But because what we have said has come true, scientists are now beginning to understand that indigenous peoples really do have an invaluable role to play in understanding the changes that are occurring. We're seeing the changes at the subtlest of levels. And these subtle changes can have very profound effects. And our people see things in terms of connections and interactions between different parts of the environment and nature. And the scientific systems are set up to focus on particular aspects of the environment, and they don't necessarily look at all the connections, although they're now beginning to realize that they need to do that. So, yes, I think our voices are now starting to be heard.
People outside of Native American traditions, I think, are very hungry to gather some of the wisdom that Native traditions have built into their culture, as you've talked about, for example, taking just what you need and having a reverence for nature and having an understanding, a very deep understanding of how it works. I mean, you've talked about even things like being able to predict the weather and so on. It seems like you in particular are a real bridge builder between the scientific way of thinking and the native way of thinking. How do you communicate?
That's really a good question. I was part of chairing a North American gathering of indigenous peoples down in Chiapas, Mexico in March of this year, where we had people from Canada, the United States, and Mexico gathered, and in proxy they represented perhaps over 1 million indigenous peoples in the Western Hemisphere. And we're talking about that exact thing. We're asking the elders and the wisdom keepers to share what they know and understand about how we got to where we are, how our people did, what this current situation is, where do they think it's going, and what do they think we need to do. And I was just down in Arcata, California, talking with the northern tribes in that area, and up in Seattle in Washington State, talking with the Pacific Northwest tribes, doing the same thing. There are a lot of gatherings now that are occurring by indigenous peoples that are focused on these kinds of issues, and the elders say that there's an urgency to get the information out, to communicate with the general public, to share what we know, that the time is now. The situation, I heard elders say, you know, they're really worried, and I've never ever heard elders say that before about what is happening. And in Alaska, the elders say, you know, what's happening here is going to happen to the rest of the world, and we need to get the information out. We need to share what we know, and we need to help people to prepare and to adapt.
I think sometimes what's really hard for people is not so much knowing what the problem is, but knowing what their role is in making changes for the better.
Exactly.
How do you help people think about this? I mean, whatever else happens, you need to get to work. You need to drive your car. The big decisions about getting a new car are few and far between. You know, how do you help people with this?
Well, you know, I like to say that, you know, it was Einstein, I think, that said that you can't solve the problem with the same consciousness that created the problem. And, you know, we can see that as an immediate example that I think a lot of listeners might be familiar with is the whole biofuels issue, where it became an initiative. Biofuels might become an answer to lowering carbon dioxide emissions into the air. And of course, now what we're finding out in retrospect is it's having effects that we didn't, that people didn't expect, and it's adverse to the environment. We're having the farmers in the United States that are shifting their food crops into biofuel crops. And that's starting to tighten the cost, contributing to the cost of foods. It's estimated that maybe the raise in the food cost now in the United States, maybe 15% or 20% is attributable to that particular action on the part of farmers. And then worldwide, we've got people who are in underdeveloped countries who are strip mining their trees in order to raise biofuel crops. And that, of course, when you take the trees out, they take the carbon dioxide out of the air, is contributing to global emissions. So that's the whole point of that is that, you know, we've got to really think outside the box. And this is where a marriage, I think, between traditional ways of knowing and Western science could really be a good thing to do, because we can see things that other people can't, and we look downstream. And many traditions literally look like seven generations down. What actions do we take today that would have a beneficial or adversarial effect on people seven generations from now? And so I urge people to really begin to think that, you know, the elders lament the fact that the initiatives that our people have talked about, you know, to replacing your light bulbs, going to hybrid cars, really doesn't get to the root cause of how we got to where we are today. and is going to be inadequate to meet the changes that are occurring in terms of stemming the trend of global warming and global climate change.
We're talking to Larry Merkuliev, and he will be in Santa Fe tomorrow, May 7th at 5:30 at Sunrise Springs. And what are you going to be talking about tomorrow?
Well, I'm trying to put a human face to this whole issue of global climate change. And since in the United States, Alaska is the hardest hit right now, you know, I'm going to talk more about that and what our people are seeing, what their prognosis is if we don't do anything, and what they feel we need to do.
You just said a moment ago things like changing your light bulbs and so on don't get to the root problem of how we got here in the first place. How do you see the root problem?
Well, the elders, and we discussed this down in the convening in Chiapas and all these other places, and the root cause, according to our elders, and I think it's absolutely true, is that we have developed a consciousness of separation. We first separate from our feelings and our bodies and what our bodies are telling us, and to the point that, you know, if we're popping pills to try to take care of this problem and that problem, and when we separate from our bodies based on the elder wisdom, we separate. It becomes easier to separate from others, and therefore we start to have more and more conflicts. And so based on that observation, they feel that global conflict is probably going to increase. And we separate from the earth. And, you know, the elders say that we need to get our children out there in the environment, get them out of the cities, reestablish their relationship to nature so that they can learn to respect and revere it and learn from it. All of our indigenous traditions around the world look at nature as our college, or as our university. It's our school. It teaches us what we need to do, and it's based on that intimate relationship with the environment where we're able to pick up the cues as to what we need to do to adapt to the changes and be in harmony with what nature is doing.
So much of the nature that we are living in right now, in other words, the way we get our food and the way we get around and so on, is based on a corporate consolidated model where food comes from huge farms and so on. Do you see a breakup of that back to, for example, family farming as a real solution, as a necessary solution?
I think it's definitely going to be a necessity, and I think circumstances may push it to that point anyway, regardless of whether or not we make the choice, but hopefully we make the choice to do that. And we talk about, you know, bioregional economics. We need to, within regions, begin to figure out what it is we need to do within our region to be self-sufficient without importing things from throughout the world. One of the things that's happening is, you know, with this monogenetics, these singular types of genetic stocks that are used in industrialized agriculture today, is anathema. It doesn't have, these kinds of stocks don't have resiliency, so that, you know, at a time when the climate is changing so profoundly throughout the world and is going to accelerate and intensify, there's going to be new diseases that come in, for example, and if that stock, one gene, one genetic type of corn, for example, gets a blight, it could wipe out the entire industrial sector in that area. You know, indigenous peoples, we've always understood the need for this, to have genetic variability. And I was down in, when I was down in Mexico, I visited a community that had over 200 different varieties of corn, for example, knowing that there might be circumstances that come in that wipe out particular stocks.
And it's not like we don't know this. I mean, that's what the potato famine in Ireland was about.
Exactly.
Larry Merkuliev, I want to thank you very much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. You will be speaking tomorrow at Sunrise Springs at 5:30 in the afternoon. And if people want more information, they can call the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance at 843-8696. Are there any websites about your work that you would like to direct people to?
Well, I think the Alaska Native Science Commission, if you Google Alaska Native Science Commission, we have a website that's in our this commission that I'm a deputy director of. We work with indigenous peoples and try to bridge between Western science and the traditional ways of knowing. And that will lead you to other links like Snow Change, where we have a gathering annually of eight indigenous peoples from eight Arctic countries and talking about climate change and what we need to do.
Larry Mikulyev, thank you so much for spending this time with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. We'll be talking about animals and during the first half of the show. Ciao.